Hi, Kara.
Hi, Sarah. How are you?
Good. I'm Sarah Posner. This is The Posner Show. And my guest today is Kara Lowenthal. She is the director of the Public Rights Private Conscience Project at Columbia Law School's Center for Gender and Sexuality Law. And today we're going to talk about my favorite topic, religious exemptions. Thanks for joining me.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me.
So this week, your project sent or coordinated the sending of a letter to President Obama about his proposed executive order barring discrimination based on sexual orientation by federal contractors. Mm-hmm. And the letter was signed by over 50 legal scholars. And the gist of it was that the Hobby Lobby decision by the Supreme Court a couple of weeks ago in no way requires a religious exemption in that executive order, nor does the Religious Freedom Restoration Act or mm-hmm. the First Amendment. So tell me a little bit more about how that letter, the genesis of that letter, and the legal reasoning behind it.
Sure. So it's well known that the Obama administration is considering doing this executive order, where it's going to most likely amend an existing executive order that already prohibits discrimination on the basis of race, sex, and national origin, basically, by federal contractors and mm-hmm. employment. So they're going to amend it and add sexual orientation and gender identity. And the real question is whether they're going to add an additional religious exemption.
Okay.
So the order already contains a religious exemption that allows religious organizations or religiously affiliated organizations to prefer their co-religionists in hiring, basically, right? So it
right.
means that they can hire people of their own religion, and that doesn't count as religious discrimination. But the Obama administration is getting pressure from some conservative faith leaders and some conservative law. One, they're circulated around the beginning of the month, urging him to add a really broad religious exemption that would sort of depart from this co-religionist limitation totally mm-hmm. and just allow federal contractors who are these religiously affiliated organizations to just discriminate on the basis of sexual orientation and gender identity. It would just
right.
totally exempt them from the whole purpose of the order.
Right.
And the letter really urged the Obama administration to model the language after the language that's currently in ENDA, in the Employment Non-Discrimination Act, in the mm-hmm. draft version that's in the Senate.
Right.
Which has been abandoned by all but two, basically, of the leading LGBT rights groups because the religious exemption is just much too broad.
Right.
It basically just exempts religious organizations from having to comply at all with the protections that the order
right.
is going to have. So we really felt like that was dangerous. And so we coordinated this letter urging the administration, you know, not to do that, not just on kind of moral normative grounds because
mm-hmm.
it's wrong,
mm-hmm.
but because the interpretations of the various kind of different applicable legal frameworks that the other letters were urging, we just thought were, you know, really grave misreadings of the law and incorrect. Both as, you know, it's certainly not constitutionally required, but we also don't believe that the Religious Freedom Restoration Act requires it,
right.
Nor does Title VII. There's sort of no, it would be a radical departure to say that a religious organization can discriminate in employment on a protected class just because that's religiously motivated. That's really not what any of these existing religious exemptions allow.
Right. So the religious exemption to Title VII basically says if you're a Catholic organization, you can prefer Catholics in hiring. It doesn't say you can make moral judgments based on your Catholic faith or Catholic teaching about candidates based on their sexual orientation or the fact that they're a single mother or the fact that they had an abortion or something like that.
Exactly. You know, across these different frameworks, I know we'll talk about them in some more specifics, but the executive order, Title VII, the World Vision Memo that we'll talk about,
mm-hmm.
they all, you know, there's differences in the details, but they basically are just the same co-religionist exemption. You know, allowing a preference for hiring on the basis of religion to hire people who share your religion to carry out your religious values oriented organization. And we might argue about whether that's a good idea or not or how broadly it should be read, but they're all basically in the same category. And this exemption that's being urged for the executive order and ENDA is really a whole different kettle of fish.
Well, I mean, I've been reporting for a long time on the 2007 mm-hmm. OLC memo and reaction to the Obama administration's decision to basically keep the Bush era mm-hmm. policy in place. And I do know from talking to advocates on both sides of this, that it is thought that the existing exemption, permits discrimination based on these moral judgments. I do think that that's how it is interpreted, at least, by some religious organizations and people who advocate for that side of this issue. So, for example, I think that you point this out in the letter that you sent to Obama this week, that one of the letters in favor of the exemption argued that the religious organizations should be able to not only prefer co-religionists, but also, I can't remember the exact phrasing, but it was something like make these judgments about or make these evaluations of candidates based on the organization's statement of faith or theological teaching.
The standard of conduct.
The standard of conduct.
Yeah,
language,
they have this weird phrase
right.
that's like the law allows religious organizations to just sort of like prefer their standard of conduct for
Correct,
everyone, which
right.
we think is overly broad. So I absolutely agree with you that there are people who interpret that
mm-hmm.
2007 memo to mean that, but I think that I and, you know, certainly at least some of the advocacy organizations who also resist overly broad exemptions would disagree that that's what it should be interpreted to mean.
Okay.
So that memo is really an interpretation of the Religious Freedom Restoration Act
mm-hmm.
as it applies to statutory grantees of federal funds. And that the memo itself is about hiring co-religionists. So certainly people are going to argue that the logic should be extended, but I think that there are powerful arguments as to why the logic shouldn't be extended, doesn't need to be extended, and extending it would actually violate, would be impermissible for other reasons.
Right. So let's say, just for the sake of argument, that Obama signs this executive order barring hiring discrimination or employment discrimination by federal contractors on the basis of sexual orientation. And that goes into effect. But at the same time, there's still this OLC memo from 2007 that the Obama Justice Department has not abandoned. Mm-hmm. And in fact, has indicated very recently that it will continue to apply. For example, in the Violence Against Women Act, which was passed mm-hmm. last year, there's an explicit provision requiring federal contractors under VAWA to comply with employment discrimination laws and not discriminate mm-hmm. on the basis of religion or anything else for that matter. Anything else that's barred by federal anti-discrimination law. And notwithstanding that provision, in its frequently asked questions about VAWA on its website, the Justice Department has indicated that notwithstanding that in the statute, that federal contractors under VAWA can request the exemption under the OLC memo. So it's pretty clear that the Obama administration is keeping that OLC memo intact. So how would that impact the absence of a religious exemption in the anti-LGBT discrimination order?
Mm-hmm. This is like a Socratic pop quiz from law school. So my understanding is that nobody really knows the answer to this question, okay. and that we're kind of going to see what happens. There are a couple of different factors, right? One is that the status of the grantee or a contractor may make a difference, right? So some organizations receive grants through these federal statutes that have the anti-discrimination provisions, and that's what the OLC memo applies to, right? Not all federal contractors have the same status as the grantees, is my understanding, under they're not getting the grants under the same statutes, and so the OLC memo wouldn't necessarily apply to them, and okay. vice versa. So I think that there's one question is what universe of organizations under what pots of federal funding that are authorized by whom and for what purpose does the OLC memo actually apply to? And my understanding is that that's not coextensive with the federal executive order, with the contractors in the executive order.
So the executive order would cover all contractors.
Right. It's all federal contractors. And not all federal contractors, is my understanding, are grantees under these statutes in the sense that the OLC memo would necessarily apply to.
So basically the OLC memo applies to nonprofits who are getting grants to provide social services under these various statutes, whereas the executive order that we're discussing would apply to everyone, including for-profit contractors like, you know, defense contractors and people
Absolutely.
Who provide services to the Department of Homeland Security or something like that.
Right. So the executive order applies to anybody. Any organization, any corporation of any size, if you have a federal contract, it applies to you. So that's a bigger universe, is my understanding,
right.
than the organizations who would be grantees under these other statutes. I mean, just think about all the services that the federal government has to contract for, you mm-hmm. know, everything from, you know, international aid, which is someplace that there are religious organizations
right.
doing some of the work. So like who does their IT work, to who brings in their office chairs, to who, you know,
right.
who caters the IRS office in Cincinnati, like all of that. Just all of that. It's just an enormous amount of people, you know, all of that stuff.
No, but have you seen anyone make the argument that under Hobby Lobby, these for-profit contractors should be entitled to a religious exemption, just like the religious nonprofits may be under these federal statutes?
I mean, I think we can definitely expect people to make that argument.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's a loser for a couple of reasons. So it is probably the case that closely held small businesses or corporations who are federal contractors have in the abstract now some free exercise rights, because basically the Hobby Lobby opinion told us that closely held corporations have some free exercise rights of some kind, right?
Or rights under RFRA.
Under RFRA.
Right.
Doesn't mean that they get an exemption necessarily, but just so that's the baseline. So it might mean that a closely held corporation who's a federal contractor who wanted such an exemption could try to at least apply, like it would have standing, you know, under RFRA. But the Hobby Lobby opinion is very specific, and I think particularly Kennedy's concurrence, which is that crucial fifth vote,
right.
it's very specific about the fact that this is really kind of factually bound. Now, we might disagree with him about the facts, about whether the accommodation is really so seamless, whether women are really going to be able to get access. You know, we could dispute that. But
right.
in the universe of the facts, as the opinion accepts them, Kennedy's concurrence in particular is very clear that this is only okay because this existing accommodation is already there and ready. The government doesn't have to create a new program. Women can get their access. You know, there's no harm to third parties, and there isn't even a big administrative hassle.
Right.
So it's hard to imagine what that would mean for a contractor who wanted to fire someone for coming out of the closet, for instance, right? What would be the sort of existing accommodation that makes that not any harm to the employee?
Right.
So, you know, they do probably have, as you'd say, you know, standing to bring the case now. We do know that a closely held corporation at least
mm-hmm.
has some right under RFRA to at least have its claim heard. But that doesn't mean that they get the exemption. And even if you
right.
prove this was a burden, I don't see how you could sort of satisfy this concern about third-party harms and the compelling interest test.
Right, right. Okay, so basically we have this existing executive order that bars discrimination. Obama mm-hmm. plans to add sexual orientation to it. It bars discrimination by federal and gender identity. But it bars discrimination by federal contractors, mm-hmm. basically, you know, taxpayer-funded organizations.
Right.
Then we also have this Bush-era executive order that gives a religious exemption to religiously affiliated nonprofits who are federal contractors that Obama has not rescinded. And then on top of that, we have the 2007 OLC memo, which basically gives religiously affiliated nonprofits, we think for the moment, the opportunity to request an exemption from anti-discrimination hiring laws from the Justice Department. Now, how all of these things are going to interact once President Obama signs the executive order dealing with the sexual orientation and gender identity discrimination is still unclear. But those are the mechanisms that are potentially working together here.
Right, right. Well, I think what isn't clear yet is what happens if you get something in the middle of the Venn diagram. Is there a organization, and I admit, you know, this sort of the intricacies of who's a contractor, who's a grantee, and what the different kind of tax status or legal status of is not my area of expertise. Mm-hmm. But if it is possible to be both of those things, and the executive order has the LGBT non-discrimination clause and does not expand the religious exemption, then the question would be what happens. But we have to remember that the OLC memo is just an interpretation of RFRA, right? So sure, I guess the Justice Department could give an exemption, but maybe that could be challenged in court, right? It would depend on who would be able to bring a claim. The executive order doesn't have a private right of action, but it's possible, I think, although, you know, on the spot, I'm not sure who would bring the claim. The OLC memo is just an interpretation of RFRA. It can be wrong, right? And so any Supreme Court interpretation of RFRA, for instance, would supersede it because that would be an actual Supreme Court interpretation of RFRA. So,
right. But still, I mean, do we have any evidence that the Supreme Court would interpret RFRA any differently than the 2007 OLC memo does?
Well, I think it hinges on this compelling interest question. Again, compelling interest in the narrow tailoring.
Okay.
So I don't think they would say, oh, religious organizations, you don't even get to ask for one. You know, you just have to comply.
Right.
Probably not. But if it, particularly when we're talking about this form of LGBT employment discrimination, where it's very hard to imagine what the accommodation is. I mean, you can, like, make sure the person gets a job down the street at the secular nonprofit. You know, I don't know what that would possibly look like.
Right, exactly.
You know, so I think that the thing to bear in mind is that OLC memo is kind of operating in this almost like informal legal way where, you know, it's formal, it's the government, but the process is kind of obfuscated, as you've written about. We don't exactly know how they're making these decisions, whether it's just a free pass, basically, right?
Right.
And it's just their interpretation of RFRA. So that can be wrong. The Supreme Court's interpretations should impact how they interpret it. I think we'll just have to see what happens.
Right. But practically speaking, it's still in place. We think that the Justice Department is still granting organizations, religiously affiliated nonprofits, exemptions there. And I mean, presumably, you know, another president could be even more sympathetic to the religiously affiliated organizations than Obama is. And his or her Justice Department could, you know, bolster the application of the 2007 OLC memo, regardless of what the Supreme Court might have to say about it. Because, I mean, so far, nobody's challenged it in court, as far as I know.
Yeah, I don't mean to mitigate the harm at all. I think that, the important thing about the executive orders and the danger of the OLC memo is that, you know, those regimes operate sort of at the front, where Title VII operates at the back. So the same religious organizations that want to get this exemption, like under the OLC memo, they have a co-religious hiring exemption basically under Title VII anyway.
Right.
So it's substantively kind of the rights are closer than it seems. But of course, the advantage of the executive order or the OLC memo, advantage of the federal program and federal funding is that there's this pre-certification requirement. So you sort of get it at the beginning of the process to find out whether people will agree not to discriminate.
Right.
So I don't mean to suggest there's sort of no harm or no difference,
right,
but I just think we don't know what exactly will happen if there's a case right in the middle of these Venn diagram circles.
Exactly. All right. Well, let's talk a little bit more about the project that you're heading up, because obviously this executive order issue that we've just dissected is not the only thing that you're working on. So this is an independent law school project that, according to a statement that I got from the organization, is aimed at reconceptualizing religious exemptions in the law, particularly as the exemptions impact reproductive and sexual liberty and equality rights.
Mm-hmm.
So beyond this question of the religious exemption from anti-LGBT discrimination, what other issues do you see on the horizon as being on your plates, and particularly in the post-Hobby Lobby landscape?
Yeah. So as you said, we're sort of a think tank in the context of Columbia Law School, or by we, I mean mostly me, and along with Catherine Franke, who's the amazing director of the Center for Gender and Sexuality Law, and has really taken a lead on these issues. But when we say sexual and liberty, reproductive and equality rights, we're talking about, you know, kind of the full panoply of LGBT rights and access to services that could be affected by religious exemptions,
mm-hmm.
and the full panoply of reproductive rights that could be impacted by exemptions. So that's a sort of broad strokes.
Mm-hmm.
In terms of the post-Hobby Lobby landscape, I think there'll be a couple of things that we're keeping an eye on. One is, I really think that part of the kind of strategy driving the Hobby Lobby lawsuit is this really strategic effort to associate contraception with abortion and kind of taint it with the social, and I don't think abortion should be tainted, but the social kind of stigma and controversy surrounding abortion to kind of push contraception into this place where, like abortion, it's not a medical service, it's not a right, it's just kind of like out there on its own with no protection and not embedded in an understanding of legal rights, access, equality, you know, the importance of it. So I think that we're going to see, you know, sort of emboldened efforts to continue to kind of stigmatize and isolate contraception, right? We may see more individuals feeling more empowered to make contraceptive refusals, for instance. You know, maybe
pharmacists, for example.
Exactly. You know, that kind of the pharmacist refusal hubbub kind of died down for a few years.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, not that it wasn't still happening, but it just, you know, became less of a kind of advocacy media, you know, kind of social focus for a little bit.
Right.
But we may see a resurgence in that. And we're waiting actually on a Ninth Circuit case about pharmacist refusals, which I think we think it was probably being held to see what happened with Hobby Lobby. I think that we may see resurgence in that.
Now, let me ask you about stigmatizing contraception.
Mm-hmm.
Do you think that's going to happen in regard to contraception across the board, or do you think it's going to be focused on the methods of contraception that were targeted in the Hobby Lobby case, specifically emergency contraception and the IUD, which the plaintiffs in those cases claimed, you know, even though it's medically not correct, sure, that they were abortifacients. So do you think that this push will focus on those methods of contraception, or do you think that this is going to be something that that targets any kind of contraception?
Yeah, I would like to think it was going to be limited, although even that is horrifying, but I don't think so. No, I think it's going to be all of them. You know, the strategy of the Hobby Lobby cases was very well done, and the plaintiffs, they got to the Supreme Court first, were very sympathetic,
right,
and they were family-owned businesses, and they only objected to four methods, only, quote-unquote, which,
right,
somehow makes it seem like not a big deal,
right,
even though they're objecting to, I mean, first of all, emergency contraception is contraception, but it's not just like any other contraception, because it's the only kind that you can take or administer after sex happens, right? So it is a big deal to, mm-hmm, you know, sort of the language and even some of the opinions is sort of like, oh, well, there's 16 forms, they don't want to cover four, you know,
right,
so they're like,
right,
all interchangeable, but it's really a category of contraception.
Right.
As are IUDs, right? IUDs are among the most effective and long-lasting forms of birth control, and cost is a really big barrier. They cost between $800 and $1,000 up
front. Right.
And there's studies coming out recently showing how many women do prefer long-acting reversible contraceptives when they can get access to them.
Mm-hmm.
So that would, it would still be bad if it was just limited to that four, but you know, a lot of the cases that were filed are people who object to all forms of contraception.
Right.
So, and sterilization. So I don't think that it's going to be just limited to those four. You know, I do think in places that are a little more moderate, maybe in like state legislatures or in courts that are a little more moderate, the kind of only those four argument may work better because you get to call them abortifacients. But look, if you can redefine the definition of what medically counts as pregnancy and abortion, then I don't know why you can't just decide that all contraception is abortifacient, right? I mean, there's no, like, their definition is not the medical definition anyway.
Right. Let's just clarify that their definition is when, their definition of a pregnancy is when the sperm meets the egg, the moment of fertilization. The medical definition of a pregnancy is at implantation. But even aside from that, the IUD prevents fertilization and emergency contraception prevents ovulation. So it's not only that they're medically wrong about what defines a pregnancy and therefore an abortion, but they're also incorrect about the way these particular types of contraception function.
Right. They covered all the bases. They're wrong about all of it. But my point really is, you know, sort of when part of the problem with the Hobby Lobby decision is that it really did nothing to give the substantial burden analysis any teeth, right? And so we're in this space now that it's made it easier. And I don't want to, you know, I don't think the sky is falling. Like, I think the Hobby Lobby opinion was limited. I think there's a lot of work to be done in further developing the law in these areas. So I'm not sort of trying to Cassandra this and call,
yeah,
you know, like, it's disaster all over. But it did not provide a searching inquiry into really what counts as a burden. You know, it really didn't,
yeah,
take up those really important questions. And so, you know, when it comes to which methods of contraception upset you enough for it to be a burden, I don't see why, you know, there's any reason to think they'll stop it for.
Right.
You know, it could extend to condoms. I mean, it could extend to anything.
And I think that the lower courts are going to interpret Hobby Lobby in the Catholic cases as not requiring Catholic-owned companies to provide any kind of contraception coverage to their employees.
Right. Well, look at the Wheaton College order. I mean, mm-hmm, you have a preliminary injunction. Okay, not a final decision on the merits, but
right,
saying signing the form may be a burden. So
right,
I don't think it'll be limited to just abortifacients. I think it'll be multiple forms.
So aside from refusing to provide,
yeah,
health insurance coverage and refusing to fill somebody's prescription, what other areas could we see these sort of refusals to either provide a service or provide some sort of coverage?
Yeah.
In what other contexts could that arise?
So I think there's sort of two buckets I would talk about. One would be the actual services. So there are additional reproductive services, right? Obviously, there's abortion, although there are,
right,
so many conscience clauses in state and federal law that it's practically impossible to be required to perform an abortion if you don't want to. But also assisted reproductive technology, mm, right, which I think, especially as we see marriage equality spreading and LGBT couples are freer to, you know, live the lives that they want to live and have children, many of them are going to need access to ART to,
right,
make that reality. And so we're going to see more ART refusals, which is sort of a double whammy. You could, you know, refuse to provide it because it's messing with embryos and the kind of conception process, right? So you could refuse to provide it to anybody for those reasons. You don't believe in the creation of embryos that might have to be destroyed or whatever.
Right, so that would be applied to straight
anyone,
and gay couples.
You might also,
right,
have people who just won't provide it for LGBT individuals or couples, right?
Right.
Or single women or whoever, you know, people, whoever they think personally or religiously motivated shouldn't have access. So you may say ART refusals. I think, you know, there's also the kind of service refusals to LGBT individuals, particularly around marriage and marriage ceremonies and marriage celebrations. It's like the Elaine photography case, you know, the case of the wedding cake baker, the name of which is escaping me right this second.
Right. I don't remember the baker case. The Elaine photography, yeah, case is the one that sticks in my mind.
Yeah. And yeah, there was a similar case with a woman who didn't want to bake a cake for a lesbian.
Right. That was in Oregon, right?
I think that's right. Yeah. So I think we'll see those kinds. And then I think on the sort of legislative arena, which isn't going to be, you know, this isn't the direct service provider, but like what will state legislatures do? I think one of the things that we really want to be working on is helping to explain to people what the Hobby Lobby ruling meant and doesn't mean, right? That it does not mean, oh, any objection gets an exemption. It does not mean you have to rewrite your state RFRA to be incredibly broad. It doesn't mean any anti-discrimination or equality bill you pass has to have a huge religious exemption. You know, just sort of trying to sort of get our interpretations, which, you know, I think are legally correct, out there about really what this does and doesn't mean. You know, what does
right,
it mean? It does mean that closely held corporations that object to providing contraception through the insurance system, you know, through the Affordable Care Act requirements, don't
have
to
do that.
Right. That's what it means.
That's all it means.
That's all it means.
But I think that, you know, so for example, the Democrats are today, I think our, the Senate is voting on a bill that would restore those, that right to access to contraception, for women who are employed by companies who are objecting to it. And I've seen conservatives object to that legislation on the grounds that it's, infringing on religious expression in the workplace.
Right.
So they've been very successful, I think, in framing this as the owner of the company has a right to free expression in the workplace. And potentially, I guess, they could extend that to an employee who has a particular religious view that's not being accommodated in the workplace. But it seems to ignore the possibility for infringing on the religious rights of people who have a different religion or a different religious view than the boss does. And I just wonder, like, how do you see that? You know, I'm just looking for the right word. I feel like that there's been they've been successful in their PR to frame this as, well, people who are very religious and work either at their own company or somebody else's company have a right to express that in almost any conceivable way. Mm-hmm. And when did that start to happen? When did we start to see that very, very broad, in one way, very broad, but in another way, very narrow definition of what religious freedom is for an individual who's entered the commercial sphere?
Yeah, that's a big question. I want to say up front that I am not a sociology historian,
right,
so
right.
I can't give you a year.
Right.
I can say that, you know, I think that there's been a real push for that in the last 10 or 20 years, as we've seen the kind of, you know, in the kind of 70s and 80s, there was this reconfiguring of the political and religious landscape, right, mm-hmm. in which sort of neoconservative politicians and advocates really purposefully went after different segments of religious communities to sort of build a new coalition that would combine conservative kind of economic policies with kind of quote unquote traditional morality practices and beliefs that are closely associated with religion and particularly certain brands of, you know, dominant Christianity in the United States in our particular context. So, you know, and there's great historical work out there about this, and Rita Siegel, who I was a research assistant on one of these articles when I was in law school, has done work, you know, sort of mapping how that happened. So there was a real push for those things in the kind of last couple of decades. And then I think we've seen that start to percolate through the courts, right? And through the kind of public discourse. I mean, there was a lot, without going too far into the weeds, right? There was a lot of fighting during this case, during Hobby Lobby and litigation and beforehand about what exactly, you know, the case law used to be like,
right.
What exactly was RFRA trying to do? Did the case law used to be friendly or not so friendly to
right.
religious claimants?
You know, right.
And people really disagree about that. You know, law professors really disagree about that. There's a real spectrum of opinion on whether it actually used to be really, really hard to get an exemption, even
right.
though it sounded like it was easy. Actually, almost nobody ever did. Or whether, no, that test was really friendly. So, you know, I think these tensions, another way to say that is, you know, these tensions have been around for a while. And I think there's some unavoidable amount of hindsight as we look back to the kind of
right.
Halcyon era when either,
right.
you know, there weren't too many exemptions or there weren't enough exemptions or whatever. But I do think that there is a, I do think that it's correlated with kind of the more recent, in the last couple of decades, kind of, you know, increasing religious fundamentalism in some way and the ties between that community and the sort of political conservatives. I mean, I almost think that one way to think about Hobby Lobby is that it's an indication of how sort of impoverished our conception of workers' rights is in this country, right? Which is, and this is, I'm completely talking off the top of my head here, so this is not an idea I've developed, but just listening to you talk about it, I was just struck by the fact that, you know, it's not a coincidence that we had the opinion from the Supreme Court in the home care or health worker unionization case on the same day,
yeah,
right? Like,
right.
we're so fixated on the boss's religious beliefs because we don't have sort of a sound system of rights for workers, and we don't have a national empathy or identification with workers, and we just sort of accept that this sort of like, this very, you know, kind of cold neoliberal, neoconservative, like, you just take whatever job you can get and whatever the conditions are, as long as they aren't sort of extremely abusive,
you
we're going to allow
happy,
them.
Right.
Yeah, you know, it's free market and we're just not going to get involved. So that's one problem. And I think the third problem is really, you know, the sort of difference between positive and negative rights in some way. You know, we don't have a strong system of positive rights of the government having an obligation to ensure that everyone has access to, you know, the healthcare they need, flourishing of the kind of human spirit. I mean, these are these very aspirational, you know,
right.
International norms, but it does mean that it's easier and for our legal system to understand a boss who says, I don't want to have to pay for X because that violates my religious beliefs, than it is to understand an employee who says, I need my boss to, you know, I need to be able to get this thing in this particular way for my religious beliefs.
Right.
So that's kind of part of the problem. You know, if this was like a ban on contraception, then that would be a different story.
Right.
But part of the problem with the positive negative rights situation is like, well, yes, you technically can get contraception somewhere else.
Right. Right.
And
that's a really interesting point. The thing that I was thinking of also is that in the litigation of the Hobby Lobby case, there was a lot of discussion of, well, there hasn't been a case before the Supreme Court on whether a closely held corporation has a free exercise right, either under the First Amendment or under RFRA. But the reason for that is not, is partly political or sociological or cultural in the sense that nobody had really thought of it before, right?
I mean, it was ludicrous.
So you had some of these, you know, you had some of these older cases, these older free exercise cases involving, you know, sole proprietorships, the kosher butcher who had to be closed on Sunday, those types of cases, which really didn't implicate the rights of the employees. It really had more to do with, you know, does this person have to conduct his business in a way that's required by the community, even though it's basically, you know, not infringing on his religious rights, but putting him at a disadvantage because he has to be closed on Saturday too. But so I just thought that whole discussion got really interesting in the sense that nobody really talked about, like, where did we come up with this idea that the closely held corporation should even have this right at all? And that obviously got implicated in the whole discussion of RFRA and whether the court had expanded RFRA in an impermissible way. And I found the court's reasoning on that to be just kind of laughable because, I mean, it was basically, well, Congress didn't say we don't want to apply this to closely held corporations. So what's stopping us? Which seems sort of facile and not correct.
But well, I think that it is. Oh, sorry, go ahead.
But I do think that notwithstanding the narrowness of the opinion limited to this insurance coverage for contraception context, that it provides more political cultural fuel for the idea of this expansive notion of the religious rights of a company or a company owner. And I think that that will fuel more sort of creative efforts to expand that idea.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think, you know, you're right. It's a real particular cultural artifact, our sense of corporations as possessing a lot of the rights in some way than individual would, right? But it's in some ways, you know, after Citizens United, it always seemed to me the odds that they weren't going to allow corporations to have free exercise just seemed nil, right? Not because you can't come up with a principal distinction between the two. Of course you can.
Right.
But if a court is interested in expanding corporate person, like no court that decided Citizens United was going to be the court that was going to say, oh no, huge principal distinction, no free exercise,
right?
You know, like, I mean, sort of when that is the agenda, then this is what happens. It's not a surprise, you know? So, but I do think that it's a, it is a peculiar sort of evolution over the last couple of decades of this sort of expansion of corporate rights. You know, like corporations have more rights than women now. Mm-hmm. There were some great graphics going around after Hobby Lobby that showed, like, you know, Hobby Lobby image with the caption, like, a person under RFRA, but, like, women, not people under RFRA.
Right, right. Well, listen, this was a great discussion, and I really appreciate you taking the time to do it.
Yes, thank you for having me. Bethany.
And maybe we can do it again sometime when there's another hot religious exemption issue in
the news.
Absolutely.
Sadly, these days, it's like every other week. So.
All right.
All right.
Thanks so much.
Thanks.